And I would like to welcome our main speaker, if you could join me in welcoming Yvonne S. from LA.
Thank you so much.
Hello there, my name is Yvonne Schulte and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Lee, for inviting me. Thank you, Kate, for your excellent AA talk. I was thinking, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have, you know, like a shared language, right? And there are so many things I relate to. And then there are so many things that are the opposite, right? And it's great that we can hear that because if you sit here long enough, we get to hear our stories, right? That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Brent, for driving me, my sweetheart here, for driving me. And actually, here's a funny story. So I planned to wear some super cute boots tonight. Very cute boots. Brent offered me his boots, which are also super cute, but and he couldn't wear them. And I was getting dressed in the hotel, and I thought, I didn't put my boots in the bag, did I? So I didn't have a pair of shoes with me. We found these at the CVS next to the restaurant for $12. It was the best I could do tonight. Is that or tennis shoes or flip-flops? So anyway, just imagine me with cute boots on, all right? I am alcoholic. If you're new, welcome. And don't ever say just 1 year. Right? Yeah, because being sober is an unnatural state for an alcoholic of my type, right? A year is a huge deal. A year between cocktails is a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I was born in Los Angeles, raised by really fantastic parents. I have a great brother and sister. We used to come up to Pismo Beach when I was little. I remember that. I remember Glass Beach, right? That was another one. Anyways, Big Sur, all of those things. I have such fond memories. My dad was an outdoorsman kind of a guy, and we did a lot of camping, hiking, beaching. He had a Jeep. We had a lot of fun in that Jeep. I'm adopted, that never really bothered me, but my parents, it's not their fault I'm alcoholic. So my parents are like perfect people. Like they're just, my mother at her funeral, her priest had spent years with Mother Teresa in Calcutta. And he said that when people die, that you hope that they go to heaven, but that there were two people in his life he was certain would go to heaven, and one was Mother Teresa, and the other was my mother, who was like she used to, at the end of the day, she would review her day, and if she had a resentment, she would pray about it, right? She was an alcoholic, she was just normal. That was just how she was on the natch. If she was in pain, she would turn that over to her faith, right? She was a devout Roman Catholic, so she thought of it like Jesus on the cross, giving her pain for her belief. And as a result of that, my mother lived a secure, happy life, and I thought she was dull. So my parents weren't drinkers. I have a brother who's their natural child, and henceforth he's perfect, right? my sister's also adopted, so she's a little bit of trouble, not as much trouble as I am, but a little bit of trouble. And my sister's 8 years older than me, and she got me drunk when I was 4 years old. And it wasn't like a big deal. I just remember my sister had to babysit me, and when my sister was 12, my sister was 5'10" at 12 years old. So everybody, including me, thought she was a grown-up. and she hung out with older boys, and she drank with them a few times. My sister's not an alcoholic, though. She just went through kind of a troubled teenage phase. But she got me drunk for the first time when I was 4 years old. And I just remember a few things from that. One is that I like the taste of beer. I liked the buzzy feeling that came from alcohol. And then I loved for the rest of my life, my sister would say I could drink big guys under the table. and I know at 4 years old, I wasn't drinking anyone under the table. But when I was little, I knew my big sister, who I idolized, was proud of me. And it also taught me that when you drink, that's the goal, right? I've never changed liquor stores to hide the amount of alcohol I drank. It's a badge of honor. You know, everywhere I drink, I want to be the last man standing, right? Like, that's what I'm shooting for every time. And I didn't have much access to alcohol, but one thing that happened from that day, it awakened a strange obsession with alcohol. I wanted to have a drink. My parents didn't have hard liquor because they just weren't drinkers. My mother usually had a glass of wine at the end of the night. Now, my mother was thrifty. She bought a big gallon of Gallo red wine, and she just had a small glass. It would last her forever, right? And I begged her. I love cheap red wine. I am sure I would love it today. I just loved it. And I would beg her for sips. And, you know, growing up in the 70s, not a big deal to let your little one have a couple of sips of wine, right? My father would have a bottle of Coors Light when he got home from work, and I would beg him for a sip of that beer because I liked the way it tasted, and he would hold the bottle and let me have the foam off the top, and that was about it. But when I was 8 years old, my family moved from Los Angeles to Fairfax, Virginia, which is in the Washington, D.C. area. And when I was 11 years old, a series of things happened that changed the course of my life. And the first one is that dad I described, the outdoorsman, right, the hiker, he suffered a traumatic brain injury and was left incapacitated. He was physically alive, but my father, the essence of my father, was no longer in his body. I was devastated. I was like my daddy's little girl, so it was just a huge blow. My mother was, as she should have been, preoccupied with helping my father, and my mother had to get a job for the, you know, she was an at-home mother raising her children, and she had to go back to work. As a result, I became an unsupervised child, and people who were in and out of the house, my house became an unsafe place for 11-year-old girls. And that year, I lost my connection to God. I stopped believing God existed. And I did not tell my mother what was happening to me because at 11 years old, I knew it was my fault. And it was my secret. I didn't want my mother to know how bad I was, that I was causing this to happen. So I couldn't tell her, but I could tell her that I didn't believe in God anymore and I didn't want to go to church. And my mother asked me if she could take me to some other churches. My mother is a devout Roman Catholic, but she asked if she could take me to other churches to see if I might find God somewhere else. And I did, and she would take me to different churches. Every Sunday, we would try a different one. But somewhere along the way, I found a Byzantine Catholic church where when you took your first Holy Communion, you got a spoonful of red wine with a cube of bread in it. So I agreed I would go to that church. And a little later that year, I spent the weekend at my girlfriend Heather's house, and her parents were out of the country. Her sisters were, high school sisters were babysitting us. And Heather had a couple of little girls over the weekend, and we were doing whatever 11-year-old girls do. But I walked into the kitchen Saturday night, and her high school sisters were drinking around the table from a bottle that said Seagram 7. And I knew then I wanted to get drunk with the big girls and not hang out with the little girls anymore. So I put my hands on my hips and I said, you know, I could drink you all under the table. And they laughed, but they gave me a liter of 7 and 7. And I remember standing in the kitchen that night and tipping it back and just, I wanted to drink as much down as I could without stopping. It was sweet, I liked the taste of it. And I just remember glug, 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 and then I don't remember anything else. I have no idea what happened. There were no boys in the house, nothing happened to me. But the last memory I have was standing in the kitchen with that bottle tipped. And then the next thing I can tell you is how I came to the next morning. And Heather lived in an unfinished, she had a three-level house, but the basement was unfinished. And I came to on a concrete floor in my training bra. I had no clothes, no other clothes, no blanket. When I walked up to the top floor, I found my clothes in the hallway, and when I picked them up, I realized why I must have discarded them, and it's because I wet myself, and I was violently ill that morning. But I could not wait to do it again. And at 11 years old, the obsession is there. And what that looked like for me was finding the other kids whose parents didn't pay attention but had liquor cabinets, unlike my parents. And it just became a thing that I would try to do as many weekends as possible. And my mother noticed that I had an unusual relationship with alcohol by the time I was 13 years old, because that's when she sent me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't remember very much about the meeting. I remember that we sat in a circle. I remember you could smoke in the meeting in those days. It would have been about 1985. I remember that they let me have a cigarette, which is just the way of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're here to quit drinking, we don't care about anything else, right? So, and I remember I met a 17-year-old boy, and I thought, I don't know what I thought AA was, but I thought that if he was in AA, he must be really bad. And I remember I asked him if he'd ever killed somebody, and he told me he had. And, I thought he was really cute, is what I thought. But I thought of AA. AA to me was like penance in the Catholic Church. You know, I get in trouble and I have to do one AA meeting. And so, you know, that's how it went. I would just try harder not to get in trouble next time. And I didn't get into trouble outside in the world. I mean, there were minor things, but not things that looked like they were alcohol related. They were things that looked like they were behavior related, because they were. But my mother had a keen eye on me. but I ended up, you know, finishing school, and here's the thing, is that I knew that there was something different about me from other people. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. To the outside eye, it looked like I fit in perfectly. I had tons of friends. I was involved in many things. I just always had a sense of impending doom that at any moment someone would realize that I don't really fit in with them. I'm not like you. You're going to be as disgusted by me as I am by myself, right? Or of myself. And when you realize, you will not want to be around me anymore. And I look like everything's okay, but inside I'm afraid all the time. And I have two solutions to this problem. I guess three, because I guess in one sense, a lot of the times I acted as if, which we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, another thing I did was to switch groups of friends before they could catch on, you know, and that often involved switching schools. I mean, that was something I did a couple of times, talk to my mother about how I needed a fresh start somewhere else, you know, and the other thing I did was drink, right? Because if I drink, it's okay. And how it's okay may be different. It may be today that I don't care. It may be today that I'm better than you are anyway, right? But whatever it is, when I have a few drinks, I'm not consumed with self, right? And I knew there was something wrong with me, but when I tried to figure out what it was, the best I could come up with was it was because my family moved me from Los Angeles to Fairfax, Virginia, because I don't remember feeling like I didn't fit in when I lived in Los Angeles. And today, I think in looking back, here's what happened. 11 years old, I lose my connection to God. I believe, based on my experience today in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I either live a God-centered life or a self-centered life. And at 11 years old, untethered from God, I become a self-centered human being. And what that looks like is a constant thought of myself, right? Like, Yvonne, why did you say that? You just sounded so stupid. You look fat today. How did she learn how to put on her makeup? How did she put that outfit together? How come I don't know how to put outfits together? Just like constant dialogue in my head, never kind, right? It's constantly about how different I am, how stupid I am, how I'm not enough, right? that's what my life looks like untethered from God, right? So when I look back at my life, I don't think it's because of what happened and my losing my connection with God. I think it's because I was okay in LA and I'm not okay in Fairfax, right? And so I thought, I can't live in a place like this. I need a big city. And I had this obsession that if I moved back to LA, it would be okay, which was true, in fact. Or I could move to New York City. And I had never lived there, but I had a pretty good idea that I would feel comfortable in New York City, that there's where my people would be, right? And so I ended up getting into New York University on academic probation, but for acting. So you didn't really need the academics for the acting part, but it was like a month before my 18th birthday when I started college. Well, when I went up to college. I meant to start college. That's what I was there for. And, you know, for those of you who are young, in those days, you actually had to go to a bookstore to pick up your syllabi. And your syllabi would have, like, all the assignments for the semester or the quarter and would have the books that you need to buy and, you know, whatnot. And what happened is I got to New York City and I knew that in New York City you didn't need an ID to buy liquor, right? So, like, obviously I had access to alcohol in Fairfax, Virginia, but I always had to plan ahead of time how to get it. But I knew when I moved to New York City, there was no more planning that was going to have to be involved. I could go anywhere at any time, and I would be served, and it was no problem. And that was, in fact, true. So I meant to start college, but today I'm going to drink, right? And I would come to in the afternoon and think, oh, my God, you're here for college, right? Like, it's not too late, Yvonne. Like, go down to the bookstore, pick up your syllabi, buy your books, and get caught up. It's not too late. And it never occurred to me to just do it right then, right? Because it's always like some big pronouncement where tomorrow is going to be a whole new day. We're going to start fresh tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up early. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to the bookstore. It's going to be done. And then later that night I would think, well, since I'm starting tomorrow, right? So I was out of NYU after a semester and you know, and I remember trying to explain to my mother that artists don't need to go to college. Mom, you know, I did end up working on a stage within a few months. It was not a stage my mother was proud of. And not one I meant to be on either. It just kind of all spiraled out of control very quickly, right? And I know about taking the next indicated action, and that was the next indicated action. And I would convince myself that it was just some, like, I'm exploring my art, right? Like, I'm going to use this in the future in my acting, right? What a joke. And I can tell you that by the time I was 19 years old, I was a daily desperation drinker. I could not stand being physically sober with my life the way that it was, right? And 19 years old, I have a, not a moment of clarity, really a moment of loneliness when he moved out. And I thought, if I just move back in with my mother in Fairfax, just for a few months, I need to, like, take a breather and start over. I can come back and do this fresh. And that was what I meant to do. And I get down to Fairfax and it's all going to be different. And I got a job bartending, like, my first week, but I heard someone laugh, but this was different, right? I mean, no, because it's not like a strip club, right? It's not dark and dirty. This is like, you know, like a club where people go dancing. So it's totally different kind of drinking there. It's going to be different, right? It's all fun stuff. It's not dark. It's light. It's fun, right? And it turns out when I pick up a drink, I cannot control how much I drink or when I'm going to stop. And I had no idea that that's what my life was like at 19 years old. And I'm drinking and somewhere along the way, I discover that I'm pregnant. But I think that this is the answer I've been looking for, because I moved to New York City thinking I was going to find my people, and I felt as much of a poser in New York City as I felt in Fairfax, Virginia. But when I found out I was pregnant, I thought, this is the answer. Having a baby is going to make me feel whole, right? That's what I was looking for. And I thought, I thought she would love me with all of her heart. I would love her with all of my heart, and she was going to fix me. And I was going to be a good mother, a cruel but good. And the day I found out I was pregnant, I quit drinking, I quit smoking cigarettes, I quit all the other things that come with the way that I lived. And I saw a doctor 4 days later, and she told me I was 2 months along. And I said, that's not great. Let me tell you what the last 2 months have looked like. And I said, what's going to happen? And she said we still had a heartbeat, so probably everything would be fine. And she asked me if I needed help, and I said, no, I quit 4 days ago. Why would I need help, right? I just, you know, I'm going to be a good mom, and I quit, right? That's it. And I didn't know that lack of power was my dilemma. I thought I had the power because I decided I'm not going to drink anymore, and I just stopped drinking. But I didn't know that I had no mental defense against the first drink. I thought I had power. And it appeared that way for a few months. I stayed physically sober. I don't know how long. I know it was somewhere between 5 and 7 months pregnant. I can tell you that I lived in an area of DC at the time, where there were the groups of guys on the corner all the time. And I remember I was still bartending at that place, and I got out of the cab one night, and usually I just go right into the row house where I rent a bedroom. And this night I stopped. I'd had a hard week. That's how immature I am. I'd had a hard week, right? And I remember seeing that group of guys, and I thought, I'll just go over and say hello to them. And then I thought, that's not what you're doing. You know what you're doing. And then I remember thinking, I don't care. But I can tell you today that that was the wrong language. It wasn't true that I didn't care. I cared very deeply about having a healthy child and being a good mother. The language that I didn't have that night was that I had no mental defense that night. I didn't know why that night was different than the night before, but on that particular night, I had no mental defense. And that night I got loaded, and I continued to get loaded with a desperation I'd never experienced before, because I couldn't stand getting sober knowing what I was doing to this little girl, and I have this sense of impending doom. I know I'm in big trouble, and I know I can't stop. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm killing her. I don't know if I stop, if it'll kill her. And I don't know. I suspect when she's born, they'll test her and she'll be removed from me. And I have no idea. And all I can do is get loaded over that feeling. And a few days before my due date, I finally showed up at a doctor and said, like, help. And that doctor did, in fact, help me. And my daughter was born. It actually ended up being a couple weeks later, and she spent the first 2 weeks of her life detoxing in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I didn't mean to do that to her. I meant to be a good mother. And because I had sought help right before she was born, I did not lose custody of her. And unfortunately for her, because she was released to me at 16 days old. And that was in February in Washington, D.C. And 3 days later, we were living in places that had no doors, windows, running water, or electricity. And I lived like that with my daughter for the first 9 months of her life. And I worked for an escort service at the time. I found that to be easier. And when my daughter was 9 months old, I got fired because I could not show up to work sober. And they cared in D.C. I was staying with my friend Tawana, who used to watch my daughter when I went to work for the service. I went back to Tawana's and I said, I just got fired and I need money, like, now. And Tawana said that it was not a problem because her brother Buttons was a pimp. We could walk down to a payphone and page him, and I could work for him and make some money that way. So that's what we did. And Buttons picked me up and took me on the street corner that night and explained to me how business works out there. I'd never been on the street before, so I'm not specifically a clue. And that night I got into one car and one car only, and I'm so grateful for that because it would have changed the course of my life. I got into this man's car, and I never took any money from him because we were negotiating for a long time. And it was a good thing that I felt very strongly about my value that night because an undercover car put on lights and said, step out of the vehicle. And I stepped out of that car saying, it's not what you think. And they frisked me, but they could not arrest me for prostitution because I didn't have a single dollar on me. But the police officer told me he knew what I was doing there that night, and if he saw me on that street corner again, he would arrest me whether I had money or not. And Buttons came up to me and said I was bringing a little too much police heat to his block, and I should go back to his sister's place, and he would send some money in a little while, and I could give it a try again in the morning. And I went back to her house, and I was sick all night. My daughter was very sick. I was completely incapable of taking care of an infant. I knew I could not care for her any longer. At 7:15 in the morning, because that's when my mother left for work, I walked down to a payphone. I called my mother, and when she picked up the phone, all I said was, if you bring me $20, I'll let you have the baby. And my mother found out where I was and brought me $20, and I lost custody of my daughter that morning. I am so grateful for that, because my mother immediately took her to a doctor who diagnosed my 9-month-old with double bronchitis and said she would not have lived a couple of more days without medical treatment. I am so grateful I did not murder my daughter. I spent what I hope were the last 3.5 months of my drinking working out of the 408 Show Bar on the block in Baltimore. Which was a high-class joint, and in that period of time, I missed my daughter's first Christmas, her first birthday, her first words, and her first steps. And my mother tracked me down in February, it was February, or maybe it was late January of 1994, and she offered me a deal. And the deal she offered me was this. She had found a facility for mothers and children that was a 1-year inpatient residential treatment facility, and if I was willing to go in this facility, I could have custody of my daughter back because we would be supervised 24 hours a day. And if I said no, she wanted me to know that she would do everything in her power to make sure I never saw my daughter again. And I absolutely hated my mother that morning, and I'm so grateful. My mother is like the sweetest, most gentle human being you could ever meet in your life. So I don't know how she found the strength to do that, but I'm grateful. I was out of answers that morning, and I didn't want to be sober, but I really wanted to see my little girl. And so I checked into a detox, I don't count detox in my sobriety for a couple of reasons, including I brought some, you know, to make it easier, but I got out of detox as physically sober as I am today. That was February 10th, 1994, which is my sobriety date. That's also the day I got custody of my daughter back. She was 13 months old, and when my mother brought her to me, she was holding on to my mother, screaming for her mommy. She was not talking about me. She didn't recognize me anymore, and she didn't want me to touch her. And that's what my life looked like on my first day of sobriety. And you might think I would be grateful for this opportunity I had, but you'd be wrong. I was so angry about having to agree to be in this institution for a year. My plan was to like get people off my back, and then I'd take off. And I almost did once. They had CPS there, and like, oh, so fast, and I unpacked. But I told them they used to make us go to 2 AA meetings a month, and I thought that was outrageous. If I feel like I need a meeting, I'll let you know. And it's, you know, one of the things that were opposite. The obsession wasn't lifted from me for a couple of years, although I didn't work a program for a long time, so that may have had something to do with it. But I was 11 months sober, and they made me go to this local Alano club, and I saw there was a table out that had flyers of area events. Like the golf thing that you guys mentioned, right? Like that flyer might be out, you know, somewhere. And I was looking at those flyers, and I saw a flyer. There was a meeting that was having a spaghetti dinner, and they were having a main speaker at that dinner, and his name was Sandy Beach. And I remembered Sandy Beach because I thought it was a funny name. And Sandy Beach used to live in the DC area when I got sober, and he used to do this 12-step workshop on Saturday mornings. And there was a detox I went through a couple of times that used to take us to hear Sandy speak. So I knew his name, his funny name, Sandy Beach. And what I remember is hearing him one day, and he said something funny, and I laughed out loud in the meeting. And the reason I remember it is because as soon as I heard myself laugh out loud, I was like, oh God, like, don't laugh in AA. That is so lame. So when I was 11 months sober and I saw that funny name, Sandy Beach, he was going to be speaking, I thought, that's the man who made me laugh. And I wondered, like, the meetings I was going to, they were like meetings of convenience at, like, there's nothing wrong with Alano clubs. Please don't hear that in this sentence. But, like, there would be, at the Alano club they would take us to, they would just say, like, there'd be, like, a 3 p.m. meeting on Tuesday, but nobody had a commitment at that meeting. There was no secretary of the meeting, no chairperson, no nothing. It'd just be, like, whoever showed up, you just figure out. And I thought that's what AA was. Like, I didn't know you had commitments at meetings. I just thought you, like, everyone just shows up at a certain time, and whoever's there, like, the person with the most time would just start, and it would kind of go, we'd go around in a circle and talk about our day, you know. That was my experience, and the meetings I was going to never touched my, I didn't hear the language of the heart, right? So I thought, why would it be funny? And I took that flyer back to my treatment facility, and for the first time in my life, I asked permission to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to that meeting where Sandy Beach was the speaker. And what I didn't know was it was a young people's thing, because I didn't know the acronyms. It was CIRCEPA, which is the Southeast Regional Conference of Young People in AA. It was a bid committee. They ended up getting the conference, but they were, you know, raising funds for the hotel, you know, I don't remember Sandy speaking that night, although he always was one of my favorite speakers from then on. But I remember I walked into a room and there were about 200 young people, and they were on fire. They were busy. They had commitments. They were running around. It was a beehive of activity. People were smiling. They were happy to be there, and there were cute boys there. And I was 11 months sober with, and 22 years old. So that was interesting to me. And a bunch of young ladies came up and they gave me their number. And when I got out of treatment, I got out of treatment like 3 months later, and for some reason I called them the day I got out. And this young lady asked me to meet her that night at a hotel in Arlington, Virginia. I didn't know what I was walking into, but it was a young people's conference that particular week, and it was the CIRCEPA conference. And that Saturday night, she timed it so that I would show up right after the banquet dinner, but in time to hear the speaker. And she met me in the lobby, and they pulled a chair up at their table for me to sit. And the speaker that night was a woman named Karen Garrison from Venice, California. And I remember that she was hysterical. I loved her. And then the next night I went to a meeting with them again, and the next night I went again, and the next night I went again, and again, and again, and again, and again. And after 30 days, that young lady who I called appointed herself as my sponsor. Whoa! I wasn't sure I was, like, signing up for all of that, but I was too scared to tell her no. And so she ended up being my sponsor. And she sponsored me for my first few months out of treatment in AA, and she was in AA. And she was the perfect sponsor for me because she was mean. A nice person probably would have killed me. And we all get what we need, right? God sets that up, I believe, you know. I remember, like, if I said to her, you know, well, I feel like, she would say, I don't care how you feel. And I remember I was going to a meeting every night, but she told me, like, I had to go to a meeting every night and had to get a commitment. And then I told her, like, well, I can't go to a meeting every night. I have a 2-year-old. And then she said, I did not ask your opinion. And she hadn't. So, like, I didn't know what to do with that. So I don't know why, because I was scrappy on the street, but for some reason she just, like, shut me up when she intimidated me for something. It wasn't physical. Like, I wasn't scared of her, but I was scared of her, you know? And I asked her how I would do that. When I moved out of treatment, I moved into the projects. I was on a welfare check, right? I had food stamps, and I had a car. A church donated a car to me. I had a little car I could drive around in. But if a babysitter was $1 a night, it might as well be $1,000 a night, because on my TANF check, I can't afford $1 a night once a week, right? And so I asked her, what do I do? And what she had me do, someone did, and I love this. I see this here. This is exactly what I did. I was in the back of a meeting, and if she was loud, I was near the door, and I would take her out. And after a period of time, they are not loud. You know what else? I had to, everything sounded so loud to me. I had to have somebody, not her mother, tell me when she was too loud, because I would want to take her out at any slight moment or sound, and then people would be like, she's not loud. I'm like, are you sure? So I had to just trust someone to tell me, because I was given the 12 traditions illustrated, and in the first tradition, there's a drunk man who's disrupting the meeting, and he can't stay because our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. He's welcome back when he's not disruptive, but he can't stay and disrupt the meeting. And my sponsor told me that the same thing applied to me and my children, my daughter. But I had to have someone else. And another thing I was taught to do, because it was so distracting, was to read the speaker's lips, because I would pretend. There were so many nights I spent on the floor with a coloring book with my daughter. A two-year-old is hard to contain, but I would read the speaker's lips and pretend to be playing, and it would help keep me focused. And as the young ladies got to know me, they would take turns taking her out when she got too loud. And then my daughter became what I like to call meeting trained. Because if you can imagine, with her upbringing, my child was wild, right? But from the time the meeting started till the time the meeting ended, she would sit quietly with her meeting toys. And then she'd be a dervish again, And I'm grateful for that. I was very sad. The only thing I have of value is my experience. I can only share my experience, and it may not be your experience, but when I got sober, I was diagnosed with heavy depression, and I felt very heavy. I wore life like a heavy garment all the time, and I thought the thing, when I thought about what could fix me, the thing when, I would look at you all and see how different your lives were, and I would say, well, Joe doesn't live in the projects, right? And Brent has a nice car, and Kate has a cute apartment, and, Lee has a girlfriend. I don't have any of these things. If I had these things, then I would be happy. And, the thing, that it came down to the most had to do with money, right? So I thought, how could I make money? And then I remembered I'd been fired from an escort service for not being sober, but I'm sober now. So I went back to work for an escort service with a year sober. I thought about talking to my sponsor about it, but intuitively, I knew she wouldn't understand. So it was a secret. And what I discovered about secrets is that in order for me to keep a secret, I have to build a case against you as to why you won't understand what I'm doing, right? And if I build a case against you, I'm separated from you, right? I can't be one of you. And by the time I was about 18 months sober, I knew I would have to take a drink to keep living the way I was living. And the weird thing was is that I hadn't even right then thought about taking a drink, not during that period of time. I thought a lot about buying a gun and ending it. That's what I fantasized about most of the time. And at about 18 months of sobriety, the realization I had, because I didn't trust my sponsor, but at 18 months, I thought my sponsor couldn't possibly do a worse job with my life than I was doing myself. And that was all it took to surrender. And what I did was, I went to my sponsor, I told my sponsor the truth, and I said, tell me how to live. I'll let you have everything. And I treated it like an experiment. You just direct me and I'll follow it. And I didn't think anything would be different. But I believe today that it was the surrender that mattered, right? It wouldn't have even mattered what the direction was. It was the surrender. I surrendered that day, and I can trace my life today, my sweet life today, from that moment of surrender. And my sponsor gave me a lot of direction. One of the directions was, because the way I was is if you ask me how I was, I usually, it involved hi, Yvonne, how are you? I would suck the life out of you. My sponsor told me I wasn't allowed to tell anyone how I was anymore. She said I had to lie when I was asked and say I was fine. And then she wrote down questions for me to ask people to pretend like I was interested in their lives, right? And so, thank you. What did you do today? She also told me I had to put a smile on my face and pretend to be a happy person. And I felt so stupid doing this. But I started to pretend I was a happy person, and I don't know where it happened. I don't know if it was 6 months. I don't know if it was a year. I don't know if it was 18 months. But at some point, I looked back and realized that life wasn't heavy. It wasn't heavy. My sponsor trained my feet to live life like a loose garment. And that doesn't mean that everything is always okay. It just means I handle life differently since that day, right? Since following that direction over a sustained period of time, really not a single day, a sustained period of time of following direction. When the escort service thing didn't work out, my only goal was to move out of the projects, and I had no idea how someone like me could do that. I thought maybe if I go to junior college and get a two-year degree, there's something I could do. And so I went to junior college, and it turns out when I go to school sober, I'm a straight-A student. I was shocked. I didn't know. I'd never been a good student growing up. And 2 years later, I still have a 4.0 at my junior college, and my counselor says, apply to college. And I said, like the state school? And he said, Yvonne, I think you can go anywhere you want to go. And he helped me apply to, and I got an academic scholarship to study at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And I studied there for my last 2 years of college, and I graduated from GW first in my field. And my mother, my mother got to sit on the White House lawn with my five-year-old daughter in her lap and watch her daughter graduate first in her field, right? I am so grateful for that because my mom was diagnosed with cancer shortly after that, and she died really quickly. But my mom saw me turn 5 years sober. She lived long enough to tell me that she knew her granddaughter was safe in my custody because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she lived long enough to see me start my first semester of law school. and I went to a very conservative law school in Northern Virginia, and I would look around and think, I know I'm the only hooker in here. But I didn't share that with them. When I graduated law school, I moved out to California to sit for the bar because I wanted to move back to Los Angeles. I had fallen in love with my home group, the Pacific Group, and wanted to be out there. And I moved out of the projects, and I moved to Los Angeles, and everything is going to be great now. And I didn't study California law because I went to school in Virginia, and I was just moving out of the project, so I couldn't afford one of those bar review courses that you're supposed to take. But I'm a good student now, so I'm just going to kind of wing the bar, and it's going to be okay, right? Except I failed. But what that did is it solidified everything I thought I knew about myself, right? I mean, I didn't just go, okay, Yvonne, you can't wing the bar when you don't know California law and you're not taking a bar review course, right? What it did was like, of course you failed the bar, Yvonne. Why did you think you could be a lawyer anyways? You know, you're not lawyer material, right? And I quietly gave up. And when I say quietly, I mean I didn't have a discussion with my sponsor about it because I had a feeling of what she would say, but she would be wrong, right? I'm not meant to be a lawyer. And I was waiting tables, and at some point my sponsor realized that my life wasn't changing, and she just pulled the covers. And I remember crying, and she said, I'm not trying to be mean, but it wasn't that. I just felt so scared and vulnerable, and like this isn't supposed to happen to a girl like me. Like I'm not supposed to be somebody, you know? And I forgot the part about we just take the action, right, and leave the results, right? My sponsor set me on a course of action. First thing she did was she made me get a job at a law firm, and the only job I was offered was as a legal secretary. And I tried to explain to her that I couldn't work as a legal secretary at a law firm or they would never take me seriously. She didn't care. She said, you work at the law firm or find yourself another sponsor. And I was more scared of her than I was of what they thought of me, so I took the job. And in a short period of time, they ended up hiring me as a paralegal because I'd opened up, because I did a good job, right? I did a good job. They hired me as a paralegal, and then they were like, wait a minute, you can write. I'm like, yes, I'm a lawyer. And that firm fronted the money for me to take a bar review course and took it out of, you know, 3 months of paycheck. And once I took the bar review course, then I was able to pass the bar, right? Of course I passed the bar with the bar review course. And here's the craziest part of that story, from following the direction of my sponsor, who had no idea what she was talking about, is that at that firm, I learned a kind of niche rich practice of law that ended up being a really good fit for me. It's what I do today. Today I work at the largest, most prestigious law firm in the world, practicing that area of law where I am a senior shareholder, right? You guys, they have no idea who I am. They think I'm like this goody two-shoes who like doesn't cuss at work. I mean, they think I don't cuss. I just don't cuss at work like I don't cuss in AA, right? And they think, you know, they know I don't drink, but they don't know why. They just think I'm a goody two-shoes. And fine, it works, right? And what a sweet life to have had that experience. And I got to raise that little girl who gave me a run for my money. But she got sober. She came to me when she was 15 years old to tell me she was 30 days sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And her sobriety date is June 21st, 2008. She just celebrated 17 years of sobriety, you know. And we share a home group and a sweet life. And I'll tell you the one thing. There's two things I want to tell you. I want to tell you one that... one thing is that I never met anybody, and I thought that just was kind of not in the, look, I've had a sweet life. A lot of fantastic things have happened to me. A partner is just not going to be one of them. And 3 years ago, I got asked to speak at a conference in Dallas, like last minute, filling in for someone who'd gotten sick. And I shouldn't have been there, and I showed up at a dinner, and at this dinner was Brent, and he wasn't supposed to be there either. He was supposed to speak 2 years before, and it got canceled for COVID, and then that happened, and whatever, and also like his host couldn't show up at the conference last minute, and his host sent his sponsee to take care of Brent, and his. He was supposed to be with him the whole weekend. Sponsee like dropped him off at the hotel. Was like, see you later. And then my hostess realized that he was alone and said, hey, I'm taking another speaker out to dinner. You want to come? And my best friend Kenna likes to say at that dinner we just kind of sparked, right? And we met and we dated long distance for a year. And then it's funny because my sponsor Pat, if you know her. She's a tremendous speaker, so you may have heard her speak, and his sponsor Harold, also a tremendous speaker. They've known each other forever, so it was like, you know, for a long time, it was just like, it was just perfect. And he moved to Los Angeles after a year, just a couple of years ago. Actually, I think you were on the road right now, 2 years ago, right? And we're getting married in October. And it's just been the sweetest thing. But I also want to tell you that that I found God again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not think that would happen because a lot of you believed in God, but I could not feel that God existed. And when I was 2.5 years sober, I had an accident where I had like a cardstock boarding pass in my hand, and I didn't wear glasses at that time. And my arm jerked up, and I sliced off the center of my cornea. I know. And it was really bad, but corneal tissue is a really fast reproducing cell. It shouldn't have been a problem. They told me 2 or 3 days of the most excruciating pain, but then you're gonna be fine. Except for that's not what happened. It wouldn't heal, and over the next few months, that hole kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They could not figure out I got sent from a regular eye doctor to the doctors at George Washington University, where I was in school at the time. Then they sent me to Johns Hopkins. We had to drive an hour and a half to Baltimore every single day, 7 days a week. On Sundays when they didn't have office hours, we saw the on-call surgeon making the rounds at the hospital, and they tested me for everything. Do you have HIV? I didn't. You know, why isn't this healing? Is it a fungus, a parasite, is bacterial? Are you allergic to preservatives and eye drops? They put me in a hospital for 4 days and compounded each drop every time and would only allow a nurse to put it in my eye because maybe I'm contaminating it and touching my eyeball or something. Nothing worked. And one Saturday, I was in the most excruciating pain I've ever had in my life. It felt like somebody had a hot poker in my eye at all times. I was out of my mind. I had to put eye drops in my eye every half an hour, 24 hours a day. I did not have to set an alarm clock to wake me up every 30 minutes. I couldn't sleep that long, the amount of pain I was in. And Saturday night, when I was Saturday evening, by the time I saw my doctor on this particular Saturday, and he said, Yvonne, there's nothing more I can do for you. 50-50, you're going to lose your eye altogether in the next week. And I was totally devastated. And I felt sorry for myself, but I decided the next day I was going to go to Southeast DC and get some opiates because they're pain blockers. Not because I wanted to get loaded, but because I felt like I couldn't live another 24 hours in the kind of excruciating physical pain I was in, and I needed something to take that pain away. And a woman approached me at my meeting that night unsolicited and told me what I needed to do was go home and pray for the removal of the obsession I had with my eye. And I've never wanted to kill somebody more than I wanted to kill her. And I went home that night and I was seething with resentment, arguing with her alone in my house, right? And then that voice started like, why don't you just take the action? Because it's a stupid action, that's why. But at some point, I got down on my knees and said something along the lines of, God, please remove the obsession I have with my eye, whatever. And then I crawled into bed. And then when I woke up, it was 6 hours later. And the first thing I noticed was that it was sunlight, so I realized I had slept through the night. And the next thing I noticed was that I only had the tiniest little bit of pain left. It was completely tolerable. It was just gone. And that morning when I stood up in my bedroom, I remember feeling God. And to me, it felt like coming home. It felt like, to me, the feeling of God is like that feeling of joy I get in my chest for someone else. Like when you're so happy for someone, like that's what God felt like to me. And I thought, I remember feeling like this when I was a little girl. And there it was, right? And from there I could work on the relationship. And I'll tell you, I saw the doctor that morning, the Sunday morning. He was the same doctor who'd seen me the night before. He had no medical explanation for the healing that I had completely, almost completely closed overnight. And he said he had no medical explanation for it. And I'll tell you that I not only received my greatest gift, I learned the greatest lesson I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that I felt sorry for myself. I thought what I was experiencing was a bad thing. And from what I thought was a bad thing, I received the greatest gift I've ever had. And that means I cannot judge what is good or bad in my life. I can just sit through it and just wait. I know that with the space of a year or 5 years or 10 years, I'm gonna look at it differently. I am so grateful for the life you've given me. Thank you.
Applause.